what's about the ROI calculation to come later.
Yeah.
So the title was actually given by Eric because I got to reply to his email requesting a title and abstract. I don't know how to put magma in the title because you can actually use other computer algebra packages apart from magma. You could even use Mathematica, though I wouldn't recommend it. I did try. I think magma's probably best suited for this kind of thing. I'll just say a few words about the problem which I wanted to do Galois calculations in connection with, which I'm going to call the SEEP problem. The full title for these things is symmetric informationally, symmetric informationally complete positive operator value measures, which is a horrible mouthful. And it was first of all abbreviated to SEEP-POVM, and I just abbreviated normally to SEEP. It's actually a pun. The reason it was given that name was because the guys in question had spent, I think, 2 or 3 years trying to prove existence for these things, and they failed. So they just decided to write up what they knew. And they were feeling pretty sick, so they called it a sick POVM. It's inappropriate, actually, in any way, because although it started as concerning a particular kind of quantum measurement, what you might consider to be an optimal measurement, at least for purposes of tomography, it's actually got quite a few other applications, including in some areas that don't have to do with quantum mechanics, or at least not obviously, such as high-precision radar and speech recognition. Not that I know anything about those applications. So it's really a much more general concept, in fact, but I'm interested in it in connection with quantum mechanics. And I'll just explain how it arises in quantum mechanics, but where it comes from. I guess everyone's sort of familiar with the Bloch sphere representation in two dimensions. You can represent a density matrix like this, where the sigmas are the Pauli matrices, and n is a unit of vector less than or equal to 1. So you have a bijective mapping of density operators onto the unit sphere in real three-dimensional space, and the pure states are on the surface of the sphere. And that actually generalizes to higher dimensions, arbitrary dimensions, in fact, because you can play the same trick. The significance of the Pauli matrices is that they're trace zero operators. They're a basis for the space of trace zero operators. So in higher dimensions, you can write the state like this, where I usually just put B for block. So it's a trace zero matrix. And the space of such matrices forms a trace zero emission matrix. The space of such matrices forms a real d squared minus one dimensional space. And if you equip it with the appropriate inner product, again, you basically, well, the complication is that the geometry is no longer just the geometry of a sphere. It's much more complicated. What you actually find is you've got a sphere of radius 1, just as you have in the two-dimensional case, but the state space lives strictly inside it, and it just reaches out and touches it at the pure states. And the interior of this thing is the state space. I've just drawn one possible two-dimensional section through the block. It's obviously not a block sphere, block body. So it's a convex body living inside this sphere with a really, well, I can never imagine the geometry. I don't think anyone can. It's obviously, if D is 3, you're talking about an 8-dimensional object, and it gets rapidly worse. The thing to notice is that the pure states are the intersection of the block body in this outer sphere. And, of course, the pure states are 2D minus 2 real dimensional, whereas the surface of the ball, the sphere, is d squared minus 2 dimensional. If d is bigger than 2, this is a bigger number than that. In fact, a great deal bigger. So the pure states are a low dimensional submanifold of this. Now, in terms of the block body picture, a seek is just a regular d squared minus one dimensional simplex that fits inside the sphere. So much is easy. You can obviously fit a d squared minus one regular simplex in here. But the interesting thing about it is that the vertices all correspond to pure states. So they all lie in this low-dimensional submanifold. And obviously, just from looking at the dimensions, it's not at all obvious you can do it. In fact, there is, well, these things have been constructed numerically all the way out for every dimension up to 67, and for quite a few above 67 by Eric, who's been doing some calculations on this the last few months, and he's got up to dimension 100. So there's really quite a lot of reason for thinking that these things actually exist in every finite dimension, though that has not been proven in spite of a great deal of work over more than 10 years.
So what has not been proven is that 6 exists in every dimension?
In every dimension.
Why are 6 important?
Well, 6 are important, first of all, because the original motivation was to do with tomography.
Let's forget about the original motivation. Why is it important now?
It's still important for that reason. They're optimal from the point of view of tomography. They've also got applications to cryptography. There's a Koch and Spector type proof using them. They, as I say, they have applications outside quantum mechanics. I think I myself am mainly interested in them because I think they're a very interesting mathematical object. I think that the existence of these things is quite a deep statement about the structure of quantum state space, which is surprisingly ill understood in simple geometrical terms. And I've got the sort of feeling, the hunch, that if you could prove these things exist, that in itself would be an important statement about the structure of state space. But I also suspect that the underlying mathematics might bring a great deal more in its sort of train. So I think they're important practically, but also mathematically. They're very interesting. to me, anyway. No, to a lot of people. Okay, now, I started at 5:02, was it?
No, you've got 12 minutes left.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, you can construct them numerically, so you can... There's a way of... that each seek... Let me just... Sorry. All the known seeks, so it consists of a set of d squared pure states. So you've got a set of d squared vectors, which you could label like this. All the known ones have a group covariance property, so there's a group of unitary operators that map you between the different vectors. And that means you actually, if you know the group, you only need to know one of the vectors, and then you've got all the others. And to find that single unit, that single vector, you can do it numerically by minimizing this thing, where you sum over all members of the group. And minimizing, finding the global minimum of that will give you the C. So there's a simple way of actually getting them numerically. Now, in practice, it gets increasingly difficult as the dimension increases. I'm more interested, in fact, in the, if you look at the exact solutions, I'll just show you an example of an exact solution. So that's a solution for dimension 12. And at first glance, that's actually magma output. So W2 stands for square root of 2, W3 stands for square root of 3, and so on. And then these are the actual components of the vector, and they look absolutely hideous. And when I first saw one of these, I wondered why the guy who constructed it. These things were calculated by somebody called Marcus Grassel. I wondered why he bothered. Because it really doesn't tell you very much. It just looks like a horrible mess. But actually, if you look a bit more closely, you'll notice there's something really interesting about it. And that is that all of the components are actually expressible in terms of radicals, that's nested square roots. And as you may recall, it's a well-known fact that if you take a polynomial equation in one variable, it is only generically solvable in radicals if the degree is 4 or less. Once the degree comes above 4, you can only solve a polynomial equation in a single variable in radicals, that is, its nested square roots, if the Galois group has a certain very special property. Specifically, it has to be a solvable group. So the fact that you can express, well, of course, these are solutions to polynomial equations in many variables in the components of the seed vector. So at first sight, it's not obvious how that extends. But at that point, I will point and say something about the way you actually do it. So if you've got a system of polynomial equations in several variables, the standard way of solving them is to construct something called a Grosvenor basis. And just to illustrate the idea, I've given a very, very, very simple example. It's got nothing to do with the seed problem. It's just sort of easy to write up on the board, on the slide. So the idea of a Grosvenor basis is that if you've got a system of linear equations, say in three variables, you can always reduce them to what is called row echelon form. And then you have an equation that just has y and z, an equation which just has z in it. And then the idea is you solve the last equation for z, plug it in there and get y, and then plug the solution in there and get x. And in fact, you can do the same sort of construction for an arbitrary equation, polynomial equation in many variables. And this is an example. So if you look at that, you can see that when you start with those three equations, you transform to get what's called the Grosvenor basis. And you see that the last equation in the list is only in one variable, and then that's in two, and then that's in three. And then you solve them, and you find the solution to that. I mean, it's an artificial example. I just did it to illustrate. So you can do the same thing with a seek. You have a system of polynomial equations in the components of the seek. You construct a Grosvenor basis, and you get a sort of row echelon, sort of non-linear set of equations. And the thing about this is that usually, in this case, in fact, the degree of the Grosvenor basis equations is the same as the ones you started with. It's degree 3. But it usually pushes the degree up a lot, and it certainly does in the seek problem. So the last equation, if you did this with a seek, might be sort of degree 20 or 30 or more. So the point is, you'd not expect that equation to be solvable in radicals. And the fact that it is solvable in radicals is saying something very interesting about the structure of the system of equations. In fact, it's saying the Galois group is solvable. And in fact, it's not just solvable, it has an extremely simple structure, in fact, it turns out, in all the known cases, which it's basically this. You have an abelian group, you've got the full Galois group, and then you have an abelian group which is order 2, and then the identity. You have something called a composition series, which perhaps not everyone is familiar with. But you have an abelian order 2 group, so it just contains two elements, one of them the identity. And then you have another group here, which is the full Galois group. And the factor group is abelian. So the Galois group has a very, very simple structure. It also relates to the group that moves you between the seed vectors in a very interesting way, but I don't have time to go into that. I'm just really talking about how the method, just giving some brief idea of the method used to establish this fact by analyzing those horrible looking equations I showed you. Possibly I'd just say briefly something about the Galois group, what it is. So it's based on the idea of a field extension. The basic idea is very simple. In fact, everyone is familiar with it. It's because the simplest example of all would simply be the complex numbers considered as an extension of the real numbers. So you get the complex numbers by adding in one number I, and then you take all possible combinations like that, where A and B are real. Now, typically, in this sort of problem, you don't extend the reals, you extend the rationals. And you can play the same game. For instance, you could just add root 2, and that gives you the set of all combinations like this. It gets a lot more complicated, because what you can put here is an arbitrary algebraic number, or collection of algebraic numbers. But the basic idea is the same. So if you had, for example, the root of some cubic equation, which I'm just writing down at random, and you've got A as a solution to that equation, you'd have the field extension generated by it would consist of all combinations of this form, where Q0, Q1 through to Q2 are rational. And then you perform operations the same way you do here. If you're trying to multiply two complex numbers, you take A plus BI times A dash plus B dash I, and you multiply them together. You use the fact that I squared is minus 1 to reduce that to another linear equation, linear expression in I. And you can do the same trick here, so you multiply two things like that. And then the A cubed term you turn into minus A minus 1, and similarly the A to the 4 term. So you've got a way of representing the elements of the field extension. And then the Galois group operations, in the case of the complex numbers, there's exactly one Galois group operation, and that's complex conjugation, which we're all familiar with. So it takes A plus BI to A minus BI. So you can play similar games with any extension field like this. I've just actually wrote out the example. The dimension 7 seek is quite simple. In fact, you don't need a computer at all to do this. You can do it by hand, which is why I've chosen it as an example. So the field generators are these four numbers. I'm calling that one R plus and R minus. And then you define those four operations. And it's, if you take all possible products of those group operations, it gives you the full Galois group. And in this case, it's easy to see that G2, G3, and G4 simply stick signs in front of the various generators. And so you can easily see that they commute. But they don't commute with G1. So you've got this structure of a... In fact, when you take the full group, it's all combinations of the generators, you have your degree 2, order 2 abelian group, which is just E, the identity in G1, and then you have another, an order 8 group, quotient group, which is generated by these things. And that's probably all I've got time for. But so I haven't really said much about how you actually use magma to do this, but I don't know that it was really possible at the time. If anyone thinks that might be useful to them, which I think is the idea of these talks, they can always ask me and I can say more. Gives a flavour of the sort of thing.